certain. Daddy cut deep. She opens her mouth to say something conventional that will put an end to this discussion. All kinds of warning bells are going off in her head now. Whole banks of red lights are flashing. But before she can, he goes on. Anyway, that's not what you want to ask. Ask what you want, Lisi, go ahead. I'll tell you. I'm not going to keep secrets from you. Not after what happened this afternoon. But you have to ask. What did happen this afternoon? That would seem to be the logical question, but Lisi understands this cannot be a logical discussion because it's madness they're circling. Madness. And now she's a part of it, too. Because Scott took her somewhere, she knows it. That was not her imagination. If she asks what happened, he'll tell her. He's as much as said so, but it's not the right way in. Her postcoital drowse has departed and she's never felt more awake in her life. After you jumped off the bench, Scott, Daddy gave me a kiss. A kiss is Daddy's prize. To show the blood bowl was over. Yes, I know. You told me. After you jumped off the bench and the cutting was done, did he go away somewhere to heal? Is that how come he could go to the store for bottles of dope and then run around the house making a bull hunt so soon after? No. He crushes his cigarette out in the ashtray sitting on top of the book. She feels the oddest mixture of emotions at that simple negative. Sweet relief and deep disappointment. It's like having a thunderhead in her chest. She doesn't know exactly what she was thinking, but that no means she doesn't have to think it anymore. He couldn't. Scott speaks in that same flat, dry tone of voice, with that same certainty. Paul couldn't. He couldn't go. The emphasis on the last word is slight but unmistakable. I had to take him. Scott rolls toward her and takes her, but only into his arms. His face against her neck is hot with suppressed emotion.
There's a place. We called it Booya Moon. I forget why. It's mostly Purdy. I took him when he was hurt, and I took him when he was dead, but I couldn't take him when he was bad gunky. After Daddy killed him, I took him there, to Booya Moon, and I buried him away.
The dam gives way, and he begins sobbing. He's able to muffle the sounds a little by closing his lips, but the force of those sobs shakes the bed, and for a little while all she can do is hold him. At some point he asks her to turn the lamp out, and when she asks him why, he tells her. Because this is the rest of it, Lisi. I think I can tell it, as long as you're holding me. But not with the light on. And although she is more frightened than ever, even more frightened than on the night when he came out of the dark with his hand in bloody ruins, she frees an arm long enough to turn out the bedside light, brushing his face with the breast that will later suffer Jim Dooley's madness. At first the room is dark, and then the furniture reappears dimly as her eyes adjust. It even takes on a faint and hallucinatory glow that announces the moon's approach through the thinning clouds. You think Daddy murdered Paul, don't you? You think that's how this part of the story ends.
Scott, you said he did it with his rifle.
But it wasn't murder. They would have called it that, if he'd ever been tried for it in court. But I was there, and I know it wasn't. He pauses. She thinks he'll light a fresh cigarette, but he doesn't. Outside, the wind gusts and the old building groans. For a moment, the furniture brightens just a little, and then the gloom returns. Daddy could have murdered him, sure. Lots of times. I know that. There were times he would have, if I hadn't been there to help. But in the end, that isn't how it was. You know what euthanasia means, Lisi?
Mercy killing.
Yeah, that's what my daddy did to Paul. In the room beyond the bed, the furniture once more shivers towards visibility, then once more retreats into shadow. It was the bad gunky, don't you see? Paul got it just like Daddy. Only Paul got too much for Daddy to cut and let out. Lisi sort of understands. All those times the father cut the sons, and himself as well, she presumes, he was practicing a kind of wacky preventative medicine. Daddy said it mostly skipped two generations and then came down twice as hard. Come down on you like that tractor chain on your foot, Scoot, he said. She shakes her head. She doesn't know what he's talking about, and part of her doesn't want to. It was December, Scott says, and there come a cold snap, first one of the winter. We lived on that farm way out in the country with open fields all around us and just the one road that went down to Muley's store and then to Martinsburg. We were pretty much cut off from the world. Pretty much on our own hook, see? She does see. She imagines the postman came up that road once in a while, and of course Sparky Landon would drive down it in order to get to U.S. Jip'em work. But that would have been pretty much it. No school buses, because me and Paul, we is homeschooled. The school buses went to the donkey corral. Snow made it worse, and cold made it worse still. The cold kept us inside. Still, that year wasn't so bad at first. We had a Christmas tree, at least. There were years when Daddy would get in the bad gunky, or just plain broody, and there wouldn't be any tree or any presents. He gives out a short, humorless laugh. One Christmas he must have kept us up until 3 a.m, reading from the Book of Revelation about jars being opened and plagues and riders on horses of various shades, and he finally threw the Bible into the kitchen and roared, "Who writes this smog and bullshit, and who are the morons who believe it?" When he was in a roaring mood, Lisey, he could roar like Ahab during the last days of the Pequod. But this particular Christmas seemed nice enough. Know what we did? We all went up to Pittsburgh together for the shopping, and Daddy even took us to a movie. Clint Eastwood playing a cop and shooting up some city. It gave me a headache, and the popcorn gave me a bellyache, but I thought it was the most wonderful goddamn thing I'd ever seen. I went home and started writing a story just like it, and read it to Paul that night. It probably stank to high heaven, but he said it was good. "He sounds like a great brother," Lisey says carefully. Her care is wasted. He hasn't even heard her. What I'm telling you is that we were all getting along, had been for months, almost like a normal family, if there is such a thing, which I doubt. But. He stops, thinking. At last he begins again. Then one day not long before Christmas, I was upstairs in my room. It was cold, colder than a witch's tit, and getting ready to snow. I was on my bed reading my history lesson when I looked out my window and saw Daddy coming across the yard with an armload of wood. I went down the back stairs to help him stack it in the wood box so the stove lengths wouldn't get bark all over the floor. That always made him mad. And Paul was 10. Paul is sitting at the kitchen table when his kid brother, just 10 years old and needing a haircut, comes down the back stairs with the laces of his sneakers flapping. Scott thinks he'll ask if Paul wants to go out sledding on the hill behind the barn once the wood's in. If Daddy doesn't have any more chores, that is. Paul Landon, slim and tall and already handsome at 13, has a book open in front of him. The book is Introduction to Algebra, and Scott has no reason to believe Paul is doing anything other than solving for X until Paul turns his head to look at him. Scott is still 3 steps from the bottom of the stairs when Paul does that. It is only an instant before Paul lunges at his younger brother, to whom he has never so much as raised a hand in their lives together. But it is long enough to see that no, Paul wasn't just sitting there. No, Paul wasn't just reading. No, Paul wasn't studying. Paul was lying in wait. It isn't blankness he sees in his brother's eyes when Paul comes surging out of his chair hard enough to knock it skittering back against the wall, but pure bad gunky. Those eyes are blue no more. Something has burst in the brain behind them and filled them with blood. Scarlet seeds stand in the corners. Another child might have frozen to the spot and been killed by the monster who an hour before had been an ordinary brother with nothing on his mind but homework, or perhaps what he and Scott could get Daddy for Christmas if they pooled their money. Scott, however, is no more ordinary than Paul. Ordinary children could never have survived Sparky Landon. And it's almost certainly the experience of living with his father's madness that saves Scott now. He knows the bad gunky when he sees it, and wastes no time on disbelief. He turns instantly and tries to flee back up the stairs. He makes only 3 steps before Paul grabs him by the legs. Snarling like a dog whose yard has been invaded, Paul curls his arms around Scott's shins and yanks the younger boy's legs out from under him. Scott grabs the banister and holds on. He gives a single two-word yell, "Daddy, help!" and is quiet. Yelling wastes energy. He needs all of his to hold on. He doesn't have enough strength to do so, of course. Paul is 3 years older, 50 pounds heavier, and much stronger. In addition to these things, he has run mad. If Paul pulls him free of the banister then, Scott will be badly hurt or killed in spite of his quick reaction. But instead of getting Scott, what Paul gets are Scott's corduroy pants and both sneakers, which he forgot to tie when he jumped down off his bed. "If I'd tied my sneakers," he will tell his wife much later as they lie in bed on the second floor of the Antlers in New Hampshire, "we're most likely not here tonight. Sometimes I think that's all my life comes down to, Lisey. A pair of untied Keds size 7. The thing that was Paul roars, stumbles backward with a hug of pants in its arms, and trips over the chair in which a handsome young fellow sat down an hour previous to map Cartesian coordinates. One sneaker falls to the bumpy, hillocky linoleum. Scott, meanwhile, is struggling to get going again, to get up to the second-floor landing while there's still time. But his sock feet spin out from under him on the smooth stair riser, and he goes back down to one knee. His tattered underwear has been pulled partway down. He can feel a cold draft blowing on the crack of his ass, and there's time to think, "Please, God, I don't want to die this way with my fanny out to the wind." Then the brother thing is up, bellowing and casting aside the pants. They skid across the kitchen table, leaving the algebra book but knocking the sugar bowl to the floor. "Knocking at Galley West," their father might have said. The thing that was Paul leaps for him, and Scott is bracing for its hands and the feel of its nails biting into his skin when there's a terrific wooden thunk and a hoarse, furious shout. "Leave him alone, you smuckin' bastard. You bad, gunky fuck." He forgot all about Daddy. The draft on his ass was Daddy coming in with the wood. Then Paul's hands do grab him, the fingernails do bite in, and he's pulled backward, his grip on the banister broken as easily as if it were a baby's. In a moment, he will feel Paul's teeth. He knows it. This is the real bad gunky, the deep bad gunky, not what happens to Daddy when Daddy sees people who aren't there or makes a blood pool on himself or one of them, a thing he does less and less to Scott as Scott grows older, but the real deal, what Daddy meant all the times he'd just laugh and shake his head when they asked him why the Landros left France, even though it meant leaving all their money and land behind, and they were rich, the Landros were rich, and he's gonna bite now, he's gonna bite me right now, right here. He never feels Paul's teeth. He feels hot breath on the unprotected meat of his left side just above the hip, and then there's another heavy wooden thonk as Daddy brings the stove length down on Paul's head again, two-handed with all his strength. The sound is followed by a number of loose sliding sounds as Paul's body goes slithering down to the kitchen linoleum. Scott turns over. He's lying splayed out on the lower stairs, dressed in nothing but an old flannel shirt, his underpants, and white athletic socks with holes in the heels. One foot is almost touching the floor. He's too stunned to cry. His mouth tastes like the inside of a piggy bank. That last whack sounded awful, and for an instant his powerful imagination paints the kitchen with Paul's blood. He tries to cry out, but his shocked, flattened lungs can produce only a single dismayed squawk. He blinks and sees that there's no blood. Only Paul lying face down in the sugar from the now-defunct bowl, which lies bust in 4 big and change. "That one'll never dance the tango again," Daddy sometimes says when something breaks, a glass or a plate. But he doesn't say it now, just stands over his unconscious son in his yellow work coat. There's snow on his shoulders and in his shaggy hair, which is starting to go gray. In one gloved hand he holds the stove length. Behind him, scattered in the entry like pickup sticks, is the rest of his armload. The door is still open, and the cold draft is still blowing in. And now Scott sees there is blood, just a little, trickling from Paul's ear and down the side of his face. "Daddy, is he dead?" Daddy slings the stove length into the wood box and brushes his long hair back. There's melting snow in the stubble on his cheeks.
"No, he ain't. That'd be too easy."
He tromps to the back door and slams it shut, cutting off the draft. His every movement expresses disgust, but Scott has seen him act so before, when he gets official letters about taxes or schooling or things like that, and is pretty sure that what he really is scared. Daddy comes back and stands over his floor-bound boy. He rocks from one booted foot to the other a while. Then he looks up at the other one.
Help me get him down cellar, Scoot.
It isn't wise to question Daddy when he tells you to do a thing, but Scott is frightened. Also, he is next door to naked. He comes down to the kitchen and starts pulling his pants on. Why, Daddy? What are you going to do with him? And for a wonder, Daddy doesn't hit him. Doesn't even yell at him.
I'll be smucked if I know. Truss him up down there for a start while I think about it. Hurry up! He won't be out long.
Is it really the Bat Gunky? Like with the Landros? And your Uncle Theo?
What do you think, Scoot? Get his head, lest you want it to bump all the way down. He won't be out long, I tell you, and if he starts again, you might not be so lucky. Me either. Bad Gunky's strong.
Scott does as his father says. It's the 1960s, it's America, men will soon be walking on the moon, but here they have a boy to deal with who has seemingly gone feral in the turn of a moment. The father simply accepts the fact. After his first shocked questions, the son does as well. When they reach the bottom of the cellar stairs, Paul begins to stir again and make thick sounds deep in his throat. Sparky Landon puts his hands around his older son's throat and begins to choke him. Scott screams in horror and tries to grab his father.
Daddy, no!
Sparky Landon releases one hand from what it's been doing long enough to administer an absent backhand blow to his younger son. Scott goes reeling back and strikes the table sitting in the middle of the dirt-floored room. Standing on it is an ancient hand-crank printing press that Paul has somehow coaxed back into working. He has printed some of Scott's stories on it. They are the younger brother's first publications. The crank of this quarter-ton behemoth bites painfully into Scott's back, and he crumples up, grimacing, watching as his father resumes choking.
Daddy, don't kill him. Please don't kill him.
I ain't,
Landon says without looking around.
I should, but I ain't. Not yet, anyway. More fool me, but he's my own boy, my fucking firstborn, and I won't unless I have to. Which I fear I will. Sweet Mother McCree. But not yet. Mother Fogged if I will. Only it won't do to let him wake up. You ain't never seen nothing like this, but I have. I got lucky upstairs because I was behind him. Down here I could chase him 2 hours and never catch him. He'd run up the walls and halfway across the sweet mother's ceiling. Then when he wore me down.
Landon removes his hands from Paul's throat and peers fixedly into the still white face. That little trickle of blood from Paul's ear seems to have stopped.
There. How you like that, you motherfuck? He's out again. But he not for long. Fetch out that coil of rope from under stair. That'll do until we can get some chain out of the shed. Then I don't know. Then it depends.
Depends on what, Daddy?
Scared. Has he ever been so scared? No. And his father is looking at him in a way that scares him even more, because it is a knowing way.
Why, I guess it depends on you, Scoot. You've made him better a lot of times. And why do you want to come all over cow's eyes that way? You think I didn't know? Jesus, for a smart boy, ain't you dumb?
He turns his head and spits on the dirt floor.
You've made him better of a lot of things. Maybe you can make him better of this. I never heard of anyone getting better from the Bad Gunky. Not the real Bad Gunky. But I never heard of anybody just like you, either. So maybe you can. Have on till your cheeks crack, my old man would have said. But for now, just fetch out that coil of rope from under stair. And step to it, you little glue-foot motherfuck, because he's...
11. He's stirring already, Lisi said as she lay on the oyster-white carpet of her dead husband's study. He's... 12. Stirring already. Lisi says this as she sits on the cold floor of the guest room, holding her husband's hand, a hand that is warm but dreadfully lax and waxy in her own. Scott said... 13. The arguments against insanity fall through with a soft, shuddering sound. These are the sounds of dead voices on dead records. floating down the broken shaft of memory. When I turned to you to ask if you remember, when I turned to you in our bed. 14. In bed with him is where she hears these things. In bed with him at the antlers, after a day when something happened she absolutely cannot explain. He tells her, as the clouds thin and the moon nears like an announcement, and the furniture swims to the very edge of visibility. She holds him in the dark and listens, not wanting to believe, helpless not to, as the young man who will shortly become her husband says, "Daddy told me to fetch out that coil of rope from under stair, and you want to step on it, you little glue-foot motherfuck," he says, "'cause he's not going to stay out for long. And when he comes to..." 15.
"When he comes to, he's going to be one ugly bug."
Ugly bug. Like Scooter, you old Scoot, and the bad gunky. Ugly bug is an interior idiom of his family that will haunt his dreams and his speech for the rest of his productive but too short life. Scott gets the coil of rope from beneath the stairs and brings it to Daddy. Daddy trusses Paul up with a quick dancing economy, his shadow looming and turning on the cellar's stone walls in the light of three hanging 75-watt bulbs, which are controlled by a turn switch at the top of the stairs. He ties Paul's arms so stringently behind him that the balls of his shoulders stand out even through his shirt. Scott is moved to speak again, afraid of his daddy though he is.
"Daddy, that's too tight."
Daddy shoots a glance Scott's way. It's just a quick one, but Scott sees the fear there. It scares him. More than that, it awes him. Before today, he would have said his daddy wasn't a scared of nothing but the school board and their damned registered mails.
"You don't know, so shut up. I ain't having him get a loose. He might not kill us before it was over if that happened, but I'd most certainly have to kill him. I know what I'm doing."
"You don't," Scott thinks, watching Daddy tie Paul's legs together first at the knees, then at the ankles. Already Paul has begun to stir again, and to mutter deep in his throat. "You're only guessing." But he understands the truth of Daddy's love for Paul. It may be ugly love, but it's true and strong. If it wasn't, Daddy wouldn't guess at all. He would have just kept hammering Paul with that stove length until he was dead. For just a moment, part of Scott's mind, a cold part, wonders if Daddy would run the same risk for him. For Scooter old Scoot, who didn't even dare jump off a 3-foot bench until his brother stood cut and bleeding before him, and then he swats the thought into darkness. It isn't him who got the bad gunky. At least, not yet. Daddy finishes by tying Paul around the middle to one of the painted steel posts that holds up the cellar's ceiling.
"There," he says, stepping away, panting like a man who just roped a steer in a rodeo ring. "That'll hold him a while. You go on out to the shed, Scott. Get the light chain that's laying just inside the door, and the big heavy tractor chain that's in the bay on the left with the truck parts. You know where I mean?"
Paul has been sagging over the rope around his torso. Now he sits up so suddenly he bangs his head on the post with sickening force. It makes Scott grimace. Paul looks at him with eyes that were blue only an hour ago. He grins, and the corners of his mouth stretch up higher than they should be able to. Almost to the lobes of his ears, it seems.
"Scott,"
his father says. For once in his life, Scott pays no attention. He's mesmerized by the Halloween mask that used to be his brother's face. Paul's tongue comes dancing from between his parted teeth and does a jitterbug in the dank cellar air. At the same time, his crotch darkens as he pisses his pants. There's a clout upside his head that sends Scott reeling backward, and he hits the printing press table again.
"Don't look at him, nummy! Look at me! That ugly bug'll hypnotize you like a snake does a bird. You better wake the smuck up, Scooter. That ain't your brother anymore."
Scott gapes at his father. Behind them, as if to underline Daddy's point, the thing tied to the post lets out a roar much too loud to have come from a human chest. But that's all right, because it isn't a human sound. Not even close.
"Go get those chains, Scotty, both of them, and be quick. That tie job ain't gonna hold him. I'm gonna go upstairs and get my 30-06. If he gets it loose before you get back with those chains.
Daddy, please don't shoot him. Don't shoot Paul.
Bring the chains. Then we'll see what we can figure out.
That tractor chain's too long, too heavy.
Use the wheelbarrow, Nummy. The big barrow. Go on now, step to it.
Scott looks over his shoulder once and sees his father backing to the foot of the stairs. He does it slowly, like a lion tamer leaving the cage after the act is over. Below him, spotlighted in the glare of one hanging bulb, is Paul. He's whamming the back of his head so rapidly against the post that Scott thinks of a jackhammer. At the same time, he's jerking from side to side. Scott can't believe Paul isn't bleeding or knocking himself unconscious, but he's not. And he sees his father is right. The ropes won't hold him. Not if he keeps up that constant assault. He won't be able to, he thinks as his father goes one way to get his gun out of the front closet, and Scott goes the other to yank on his boots. He'll kill himself if he goes on like that. But then he thinks of the roar he heard bursting out of his brother's chest, that impossible cat murder roar, and doesn't really believe it. And as he runs coatless into the cold, he thinks he might even know what's happened to Paul. There's a place where he can go when Daddy has hurt him, and he has taken Paul there when Daddy has hurt Paul. Yes, plenty of times. There are good things in that place, beautiful trees and healing water, but there are also bad things. Scott tries not to go there at night, and when he does, he's quiet and comes back quick, because the deep intuition of his child's heart tells him night is when the bad things mostly come out. Night is when they hunt. If he can go there, it is so hard to believe that something, a bad gunky something, could get inside Paul and then come over here? Something that saw him and marked him? Or maybe just a dumb germ that crawled up his nose and stuck in his brain? And if so, whose fault is that? Who took Paul in the first place? In the shed, Scott throws the light chain in the wheelbarrow. That's easy, the work of only seconds. Getting the tractor chain in there is a lot harder. The tractor chain is perfectly huge, talking all the while in its clanky language, which is all steel vowels. Twice, heavy loops slip through his trembling arms, the second time pinching his skin and dragging it open, bringing blood in bright rosettes. The third time, he almost has it in the wheelbarrow when a 20-pound armload of links lands crooked, on the side of the barrow bed instead of on the square, and the entire load of chain link topples over on Scott's foot, burying it in steel and making him scream a perfect soprano choir cry of pain.
"Scooter, you coming for the turn of 2000? Daddy bawls from the house. "If you're coming, you better damn well motherfucking come."
Scott looks that way, eyes wide and terrified, then sets the wheelbarrow up again and bends over the big greasy heap of chain. His foot will still be bruised gaudy a month later, and he'll feel pain there all the way to the end of his life. That's one problem traveling to that other place is never able to fix. But at the same time, he feels nothing after the initial flare. He again begins the job of loading the links into the wheelbarrow, feeling the hot sweat go rolling down his sides and back, smelling the wild stink of it, knowing that if he hears a gunshot, it will mean Paul's brains are out on the cellar floor, and it's his fault. Time becomes a physical thing with weight, like dirt, like chain. He keeps expecting Daddy to yell at him again from the house, and when he still hasn't by the time Scott begins trundling the wheelbarrow back toward the yellow gleam of the kitchen lights, Scott begins to have a different fear. Paul has gotten a loose after all. It isn't Paul's brains lying down there on the sour-smelling dirt. It's Daddy's guts, pulled from his living stomach by the thing that was Scott's brother just this afternoon. Paul's up the stairs and hiding in the house, and as soon as Scott goes inside, the bull hunt will start. Only this time, he will be the prize. All that's his imagination, of course, his damned old imagination that runs like a wild-eyed night horse. But when his father leaps out onto the porch, it has done enough work so that for a moment, Scott sees not Andrew Landon, but Paul, grinning like a goblin, and he shrieks. When he raises his hands to guard his face, the wheelbarrow almost tips over again. Would have if Daddy hadn't reached out to steady it. Then he raises one of those hands to swat his son, but lowers it almost at once. Later there may be swatting, but not now. Now he needs him. So instead of hitting, Daddy only spits into his right hand and rubs it against his left. Then he bends, oblivious of the cold out here on the back stoop in his underwear shirt, and grabs hold of the wheelbarrow's front end.
I'm gonna yank it up, Scooter. You hang on those handles and steer, and don't let the mother tip. I gave him another tonk, I had to, but it won't keep him out long. If we spill this load of chain, I don't think he's gonna live through the night. I won't be able to let him. You understand?
Scott understands that his brother's life is now riding in a seriously overloaded wheelbarrow filled with chain that weighs 3 times what he does. For one wild moment, he seriously considers simply running away into the windy dark and as fast as he can go. Then he grabs the handles. He is unaware of the tears spilling from his eyes. He nods at his daddy, and his daddy nods back. What passes between them is nothing but life and death.
On three. One. Two. Keep it straight now, you little whore dog. Three!
Sparky Landon lifts the wheelbarrow from the ground to the stoop with a cry of effort that escapes in white vapor. His underwear shirt splits open beneath one arm, and a tuft of crazy ginger hair springs free. While the overloaded barrow is in the air, the damn thing yaws first left and then right, and then the boy thinks, "Stay up, you mother, you whore dog, mother smuck." He corrects each tilt, crying at himself not to push too hard, not to overdo it, you stupid mother, you stupid whore dog, bad gunky mother. And it works, but Sparky Landon wastes no time in congratulations. What Sparky Landon does is to back his way into the house, rolling the wheelbarrow after him. Scott limps behind on his ballooning foot. In the kitchen, Daddy turns the wheelbarrow around and trundles it straight for the cellar door, which he has closed and bolted. The wheel makes a track through the spilled sugar. Scott never forgets that.
Get the door, Scott.
Daddy, what if he's there?
Then I'll knock him galley west with this thing. If you want a shot at saving him, quit running your nonsense and open that smoggin' door.
Scott pulls back the bolt and opens the door. Paul isn't there. Scott can see Paul's bloated shadow still attached to the pole, and something that has been strung up high and tight inside him relaxes a little.
Stand aside, son.
Scott does. His father runs the wheelbarrow to the top of the cellar stairs. Then, with another grunt, he tips it up, breaking the barrow's wheel with one foot when it tries to back roll. The chain hits the stairs with a mighty, unmusical clang, splintering two of the risers and then crashing most of the way down. Daddy slings the wheelbarrow to one side and starts down himself, reaching the come-to-rest chain at the halfway mark and kicking it ahead of him the rest of the way. Scott follows and has just stepped over the first broken riser when he sees Paul lolling sideways from the post, the left side of his face now covered with blood. The corner of his mouth is twitching senselessly. One of his teeth lies on the shoulder of his shirt.
What'd you do to him? Scott nearly screams.
Whacked him with the board, I had to,
his father replies, sounding oddly defensive.
He was coming round, and you were still out there playing fiddly fuck in the shed. He'll be all right. You can't hurt him much when they're bad gunky.
Scott barely hears him. Seeing Paul covered with blood that way has swept what happened in the kitchen from his mind. He tries to dart around Daddy and get to his brother, but Daddy grabs him.
Not unless you don't want to go on living,
Sparky Landon says. And what stops Scott isn't so much the hand on his shoulder as the terrible tenderness he hears in his father's voice.
Because he'll smell you if you get right up close. Even unconscious. Smell you and come back.
He sees his younger son looking up at him and nods.
Oh, yeah. He's like a wild animal now. A man-eater. And if we can't find a way to hold him, we'll have to kill him. Do you understand?
Scott nods, then voices one loud sob that sounds like the bray of a donkey. With that same terrible tenderness, Daddy reaches out, wipes snot from his nose, and flicks it on the floor.
Then stop your whinging and help me with these chains. We'll use that central support pole and the table with the printing press on it. That damn press has got to weigh 400 or 500 pounds.
What if those things aren't enough to hold him?
Sparky Landon shakes his head slowly.
Then I don't know.
16. Lying in bed with his wife, listening to the antlers creak in the wind, Scott says,
It was enough. For 3 weeks at least, it was enough.
That's where my brother Paul had his last Christmas, his last New Year's Day, and the last 3 weeks of his life. That stinking cellar. He shakes his head slowly. She feels the movement of his hair against her skin, feels how damp it is. It's sweat. It's on his face, too, so mixed with tears she can't tell which is which. You can't imagine what those 3 weeks were like, Lisey. Especially when my daddy went to work and it was just him and me. It and me. Your father went to work? We had to eat, didn't we? And we had to pay for the number two, because we couldn't heat the whole house with wood, although God knows we tried. Most of all, we couldn't afford to make people suspicious. Daddy explained it all to me. I bet he did, Lisey thinks grimly, but says nothing. I told Daddy to cut him and let the poison out like he always did before, and Daddy said it wouldn't do any good. Cutting wouldn't help a mite because the bad gunky had gone to his brain. And I knew it had. That thing could still think, though, at least a little. When Daddy was gone, it would call my name. It would say it had made me a bool, a good bool, and the N was a candy bar and an RC. Sometimes it even sounded enough like Paul, so I'd go to the cellar door and put my head to the wood and listen, even though I knew it was dangerous. Daddy said it was dangerous, said not to listen, and always to stay away from the cellar when I was alone, and to stick my fingers in my ears and say prayers real loud, or yell, "Smuck you, mother, smuck you, motherfucker, smuck you and the horse you rode in on," because that and prayers both came to the same, and at least they'd shut him out. But not to listen, because he said Paul was gone, and there wasn't nothing in the cellar but a bool devil from the land of the blood bools, and he said, "The devil can fascinate, Scoot. No one knows better than the Landons how the devil can fascinate, and the Landros before him. First he fascinates the mind, and then he drinks up the heart." Mostly I did what he said, but sometimes I went close and listened and pretended it was Paul, because I loved him and wanted him back, not because I really believed, and I never pulled the bolt. Here there falls a long pause. His heavy hair slips restlessly against her neck and chest, and at last he says in a small, reluctant child's voice, "Well, once I did, and I didn't open the door. I never opened that cellar door unless Daddy was home, and when Daddy was home, he only screamed and made the chains rattle and sometimes hooted like an owl. And when he did that, sometimes Daddy, he'd hoot back. It was like a joke, you know, how they hooted at each other. Daddy in the kitchen and the, you know, chained up in the cellar. And I'd be as scared even though I knew it was a joke, because it was like they were both crazy. Crazy and talking winter owl talk to each other. And I'd think, only one left, and that's me. Only one who ain't bad gunky. And that one not even 11. And what would they think if I went to Muley's and told? But it didn't do no good thinking about Muley's, because if he is home, he'd chase after me and drag me back. And if he wasn't, if they believed me and came up to the house with me, they'd kill my brother. If my brother was still in there somewhere. And take me away and put me in the poor home. Daddy said without him to take care of me and Paul, we'd have to go to the poor home where they put a clopin on your dick if you pee in your bed. And the big kids, you have to give the big kids blowjobs all night long. He stops, struggling, caught somewhere between where he is and where he was. Outside the antlers, the wind gusts and the building groans. She wants to believe that what he's telling her cannot be true, that it is some rich and dreadful childhood hallucination, but she knows it is true, every awful word. When he resumes, she can hear him trying to regain his adult voice, his adult self. "There are people in mental institutions, often people who've suffered catastrophic frontal lobe traumas, who regress to animal states. I read about it. But it's a process that usually occurs over a course of years. This happened to my brother all at once. And once it had, once he'd crossed that line. Scott swallows. The click in his throat is as loud as a turning light switch. When I came down the cellar stairs with his food, meat and vegetables on a pie plate, the way you'd bring food to a big dog like a Great Dane or a German Shepherd, he'd rushed to the end of the chains that held him to the post, one around his neck and one around his waist, with drool flying from the corners of his mouth, and then the whole works would snub up and he'd go flying, still howling and barking like a bull devil. Only sort of strangled till he got his breath back, you know. Yes, she says faintly. You had to put the plate on the floor. I still remember the smell of that sour dirt when I was bent over. I'll never forget it. And then push it to where he could get it. We had a busted rake handle for that. It didn't do to get too close. He'd claw you, maybe pull you in. I didn't need Daddy to tell me that if he caught me, he'd eat as much of me as he could, alive and screaming. And this was the brother who made the bulls, the one who loved me. Without him, I never would have made it. Without him, Daddy would have killed me before I made five. Not because he meant to, because he was in his own bad gunky. Me and Paul made it together. Buddy system, you know? Lisi nods. She knows. Only that January, my buddy was cross-chained in the cellar, to the post and to the table with the printing press on it, and you could measure the boundary of his world by this arc of turds, where he went to the end of his chains and squatted and shat. For a moment, he puts the heels of his hands to his eyes. The cords stand out on his neck. He breathes through his mouth, long, harsh, shaking breaths. She doesn't think she has to ask him where he learned the trick of keeping his grief silent, that she now knows. When he's still again, she asks, "How did your father get the chains on him in the first place? Do you remember?" "I remember everything, Lisi, but that doesn't mean I know everything. Half a dozen times he'd put stuff in Paul's food, of that I'm positive. I think it was some kind of animal tranquilizer, but how he got it I have no idea. Paul gobbled down everything we gave him except for greens, and usually food energized him. He'd yowl and bark and leap around. He'd run to the end of his chains, trying to break them, I guess, or jump up and pound his fists on the ceiling until his knuckles bled. Maybe he was trying to break through, or maybe it was just for the joy of it. Sometimes he'd lie down in the dirt and masturbate. But once in a while he'd only be active for 10 or 15 minutes and then stop. Those were the times Daddy must have given him the stuff. He'd squat down, muttering, then fall over on his side and put his hands between his legs and go to sleep. The first time he did that, Daddy put on these 2 leather belts he made, except I guess you'd call the one that went around Paul's neck a choker, right? They had big metal claps at the back. He'd loop the chains through them, the tractor chain through the waist belt clap, the lighter chain through the choker belt clap at the nape of his neck. Then he used a little hand torch to weld them claps shut. And that was how Paul was trussed. When he woke up, he was wild to find himself that way. Like to shook the house down. The flattened nasal accents of rural Pennsylvania have crept so far into his voice that house becomes almost Germanic, almost house. We stood at the top of the stairs watching him. And I begged Daddy to let him out before he broke his neck or choked himself. But Daddy, he said he won't choke. Daddy was right. What happened after 3 weeks was he started to pull table and even center post, the steel center post that held up the kitchen floor. But he never broke his neck and he never choked himself. The other times Daddy knocked him out was to see if I could take him to Booya Moon. Did I tell you that's what me and Paul called it, the other place? Yes, Scott. Crying herself now, letting the tears flow, not wanting him to see her wiping her eyes, not wanting to let him see her pitying that boy in that farmhouse. Daddy want to see if I could take him and make him better like the times when Daddy cut him, or like that one time Daddy poke his eye with the pliers and make it come a little way out, and Paul cried and cried because he couldn't hardly see good, or once Daddy yell at me and say, "Scoot, you little whore dog, you mother-killing mother," for tracking in the spring muddy and push me down.
and cracked my tailbone so I couldn't walk so well. Only after I went and had a bull, you know, a prize, my tailbone was okay again. He nods against her. And Daddy, he see and give me a kiss and say, Scott, you one in a million. I love you, you little motherfucker. And I kiss him and say, Daddy, you one in a million. I love you, you big motherfucker. And he laughed.
Scott pulls back from her, and even in the gloom, she can see that his face has almost become a child's face, and she can see the goony bird wonder there.
He laughed so hard he almost fell out his chair. I made my father laugh.
She has a thousand questions and doesn't dare ask a single one. Isn't sure she could ask a single one. Scott put a hand to his face, rubs it, looks at her again, and he's back. Just like that.
Christ, Lisey, he says. I've never talked about this stuff, never, not to anyone. Are you okay with this?
Yes, Scott.
You're one hell of a brave woman, then. Have you started telling yourself it's all bullshit yet?
He's even grinning a little. It's an uncertain grin, but it's genuine enough, and she finds it dear enough to kiss. First one corner, then the other, just for balance.
Oh, I tried, she says. It didn't work. Because of how we boomed out from under the yum-yum tree?
Is that what you call it?
That was Paul's name for a quick trip.
Just a quick trip that got you from here to there.
That was a boom.
Like a bull, only with an M.
That's right, he says.
Or like a book.
A book's a bull, only with a K.
17.
I guess it depends on you, Scoot.
These are his father's words. They linger and do not leave.
I guess it depends on you.
But he is only 10 years old, and the responsibility of saving his brother's life and sanity, maybe even his soul, weighs on him and steals his sleep as Christmas and New Year's pass and cold, snowy January begins.
You've made him better a lot of times. You've made him better of a lot of things.
It's true, but there's never been anything like this, and Scott finds he can no longer eat unless Daddy stands beside him, hectoring him into each bite. The lowest, snuffling cry from the thing in the cellar unzips his thin sleep, but most generally that's okay, because most generally what he's leaving behind are lurid, red-painted nightmares. In many of these he finds himself alone in Buya Moon, after dark, sometimes in a certain graveyard near a certain pool, a wilderness of stone markers and wooden crosses, listening as the laughers cackle and smelling as the formerly sweet breeze begins to smell dirty down low, where it combs through the tangles of brush. You can come to Buya Moon after dark, but it's not a good idea. And if you find yourself there once the moon has fully risen, you want to be quiet. Just as quiet as a sweet mother. But in his nightmares, Scott always forgets and is appalled to find himself singing Jambalaya at the top of his voice.
Maybe you can make him better of this.
But the first time Scott tries, he knows it's probably impossible. He knows as soon as he puts a tentative arm around the snoring, stinking, beshitted thing curled at the foot of the steel support post. He might as well try to strap a grand piano on his back and then do the cha-cha with it. Before, he and Paul have easily gone to that other world, which is really only this world turned inside out like a pocket, he will later tell Lisey. But the snoring thing in the cellar is an anvil, a bank safe, a grand piano strapped to a 10-year-old's back. He retreats to Daddy, sure he'll be paddled and not sorry. He feels that he deserves to be paddled, or worse. But Daddy, who sat at the foot of the stairs with a stove length in one hand watching the whole thing, doesn't paddle or strike with his fist. What he does is brush Scott's dirty, clumpy hair away from the nape of his neck and plant a kiss there with a tenderness that makes the boy quake.
Ain't really surprised, Scott. Bad Gunky likes it right where it is.
Daddy, is Paul in there at all anymore?
Dunno.
Now he's got Scott between his open spread legs so that there are green dickies on either side of the boy. Daddy's hands are locked loosely around Scott's chest and his chin is on Scott's shoulder. Together, they look at the sleeping thing curled at the foot of the post. They look at the chains. They look at the arc of turds that mark the border of its basement world.
What do you think, Scott? What do you feel?
He considers lying to Daddy, but only for a moment. He won't do that when the man's arms are around him. Not when he feels Daddy's love coming through in the clear, like WWVA at night. Daddy's love is every bit as true as his anger and madness, if less frequently seen and even less frequently demonstrated. Scott feels nothing, and reluctantly says so.
Little buddy, we can't go on this way.
Why not? He's eaten, at least.
Sooner or later, someone will come and hear him down here. A smuckin' door-to-door salesman. One lousy fuller brushman, that's all it'd take.
He'll be quiet. Bad gunky'll make him be quiet.
Maybe. Maybe not. There's no telling what bad gunky'll do, not really. And there's the smell. I can sprinkle lime until I'm blue in the face, and that shit stink is still gonna come up through the kitchen floor. But most of all, Scooter, can't you see what he's doing to that motherless table with the printing press on it? And the post? The sweet mother post?
Scott looks. At first he can barely credit what he's seeing, and of course he doesn't want to credit what he's seeing. That big table, even with 500 pounds of ancient hand-crank Stratton printing press on it, has been pulled at least 3 feet from its original position. He can see the square marks in the hard-packed earth where it used to be. Worse still is the steel post, which butts against a flat metal flange at its top end. The white-painted flange presses in turn against the beam running directly beneath their kitchen table. Scott can see a dark right angle tattooed on that white piece of metal and knows it's where the support post used to rest. Scott measures the post itself with his eye, trying to pick up a lean. He can't, not yet. But if the thing continues to yank on it with all its inhuman strength, day in and day out. Daddy, can I try again? Daddy sighs. Scott cranes around to look into his hated, feared, loved face. Daddy?
Have on till your cheeks crack, Daddy says. Have on and good luck to you.
18. Silence in the study over the barn, where it was hot and she was hurt and her husband was dead. Silence in the guest room, where it's cold and her husband is gone. Silence in the bedroom at the Antlers, where they lie together, Scott and Lisi, now we are two. Then the living Scott speaks for the one that's dead in 2006 and gone in 1996, and the arguments against insanity do more than fall through. For Lisi Landon, they finally collapse completely, everything the same. 19. Outside their bedroom at the Antlers, the wind is blowing and the clouds are thinning. Inside, Scott pauses long enough to get a drink from the glass of water he always keeps by the side of the bed. The interruption breaks the hypnotic regression that has once more begun to grip him. When he resumes, he seems to be telling instead of living, and she finds this an enormous relief. I tried twice more, he says. Tried, not trite. I used to think trying that last time was how I got him killed. Right up until tonight I thought that. But talking about it, hearing myself talk about it, has helped more than I ever would have believed. I guess psychoanalysts have got something with that old talking cure stuff after all, huh? I don't know. Nor does she care. Did your father blame you? Thinking of course he did. But once more she seems to have underestimated the complexity of the little triangle that existed for a while on an isolated farmyard hill in Martinsburg, Pennsylvania. Because after hesitating a moment, Scott shakes his head. No. It might have helped if he'd taken me in his arms, like he did after the first time I tried, and told me it wasn't my fault, wasn't anybody's fault, that it was just the bad gunky, like cancer or cerebral palsy or something. But he never did that either. He just hauled me away with one arm. I hung there like a puppet whose strings had been cut, and afterwards we just... In the brightening dimness, Scott explains all his silence about his past with one terrible gesture. He puts a finger to his lips for a second. It is a pallid exclamation point below his wide eyes, and holds it there. Shh. Lisi thinks of how it was after Jody got pregnant and went away, and nods her understanding. Scott gives her a grateful look. 3 tries in all, he resumes. The second was only 3 or 4 days after my first go. I tried as hard as I could, but it was just like the first time. Only by then you could see a lean in the post he was chained to, and there was a second arc of turds farther out because he'd moved the table a little more and gotten a little extra slack in that chain. Daddy was starting to be afraid he might snap one of the table legs, even though they were metal too. After my second try, I told Daddy I was pretty sure I knew what was wrong. I couldn't do it, couldn't take him, because he was always knocked out when I got close to him. And Daddy said, "Well, what's your plan, Scooter? You want to grab him when he's awake and raving? He'd rip your smocking head off." I said I knew it. I knew more than that, Lisi. I knew that if he didn't rip my head off in the cellar, he'd rip it off on the other side, in Booyah Moon. So then I asked Daddy if he couldn't knock him out just a little. You know, make him woozy. Enough so I could get in close and hold him the way I was holding you today, under the yum-yum tree. "Oh, Scott," she says. She is afraid for the 10-year-old boy, even though she knows it must have come out all right. Knows he lived to father the young man lying beside her. Daddy said it was dangerous. "Playing with fire there, Scoot," he said. I knew I was, but there wasn't any other way. We couldn't keep him in the cellar much longer, even I could see that. And then Daddy, he kind of ruffled my hair and said, "What happened to the little pissant is scared to jump off the hall bench?" I was surprised he even remembered that because he was so far in the bad gunky, and I was proud. Lisi thinks what a dismal life it must have been, where pleasing such a man could make a child proud, and reminds herself he was only 10. 10. And alone with a monster in the cellar much of the time. The father was also a monster, but at least a rational one some of the time. A monster capable of doling out the occasional kiss. Then, Scott looks up into the dim. For a moment the moon comes out. It dashes a pale and playful paw across his face before retreating into the clouds once more. When he resumes, she hears the child beginning to take over once more. "Daddy. See, Daddy never asked what I saw or where I went or what I did when I went there, and I don't think he ever asked Paul. I don't know if Paul even remembered too much, but he'd come close then. He said, 'And if you take him like that, Scoot, what happens if he wakes up? Is he just gonna be suddenly all better? Because if he ain't, I won't be there to help you.' But I thought about that, see? Thought about it, till it seemed like my brains bust wide open." Scott gets up on one elbow and looks at her. "I knew it had to end as well as Daddy. Maybe even better. Because of the post. And the table. But also because of how he's losing weight and getting sores on his face from not eating the right food. We give him vegetables, but everything except the taters and onions he's slying away from him in one of his eyes, the one Daddy hurt before, had come all over milky white on top of the red. Also, more of his teeth was falling out, and one of his elbows had come over all crooked. He was falling apart from being down here, Lisi. And what wasn't falling apart from no sunlight and wrong food, he was beaten to death. Do you see?" She nods. "So I had this little idea I told Daddy. He said, 'You think you're pretty motherfucking smart for 10, don't you?' And I said, 'No, I wasn't smart about hardly anything. And if he thought there was some other way that was safer and better, then okay. Only he didn't. He said, 'I think you're pretty motherfucking smart for 10, tell you that. And you turned out to have some guts in you after all. Unless you back out.' 'I won't back out,' I said. And he said, 'You won't need to, Scooter, because I'll be standing right at the foot of the stairs with my sweet mother deer gun.'" 20. Daddy stands at the foot of the stairs with his deer gun, his .30-06 in his hands. Scott stands beside him, looking at the thing chained to the metal post and the printing press table, trying not to tremble. In his